Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Ukraine says it has pushed back Russian forces around Kyiv, retaking control of some areas near the capital amid fierce battles. Israeli forces killed one Palestinian and injured dozens more in fresh raids on cities and villages in the occupied West Bank. Also ahead, the 2022 World Cup draw. Iran will face the United States and England in Group B of the World Cup Finals. Thank you for joining us. Top story this hour is day 38 of Russia's military offensive against Ukraine, and there's been a potential expansion of the theater of war. Russia says the conflict has for the first time spilled into its borders. Moscow has accused Kyiv of carrying out an airstrike on a fuel depot in the Russian city of Belgorod. It is warned that the helicopter attack could hamper peace talks. The Ukrainian foreign minister says he cannot confirm or deny the strike because he is not privy to all military information. Meanwhile, inside Ukraine, local officials say Russian forces are withdrawing from the Chernihiv region but have not yet left entirely. Russia had said it would cut back operations around the city as well as the capital, Kyiv, in an effort to boost mutual trust and negotiations. Ukrainian officials are also reporting gains made outside Kyiv and also in the southern Kherson region. But the Ukrainian president, alongside Western officials, says Russia is regrouping and preparing powerful strikes on the country's east and south. Russia's energy giant Gazprom says it is exiting from its business in Germany as Moscow's deadline passes for a switch in gas payments from euro to ruble. The company said it had terminated its participation in Gazprom Germania and all of its assets. Berlin had reportedly threatened to expropriate Gazprom and Rosneft units in the country amid concerns over the security of energy supplies. The Kremlin said any such move would be a violation of international law. Russian President Vladimir Putin has signed a decree to impose ruble pricing for gas on buyers from unfriendly countries, including the EU, as of April the 1st. Germany, which depends on Russian gas for about 40% of its needs, rejected the request. Its economy minister said Berlin would not be, quote, blackmailed by Putin. However, the German government later said it was examining the decree to determine its specific impact. Russian natural gas is still flowing to Europe. The killing of a Palestinian by Israeli forces in the West Bank city of Al-Khalil has triggered a wave of condemnations from across the occupied territories. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry said the killing was carried out at the order of Israeli officials. The ministry called on the United Nations and its various bodies to adopt international resolutions on the Palestinian issue. It further demanded that the International Criminal Court quickly launch investigations into the crimes committed by the Israeli regime and settlers. Palestinian resistance movements, the Islamic Jihad and Hamas, also condemned the Israeli violence and killings, warning that these actions will not go unanswered. Earlier on Friday, Israeli forces also injured 130 people in raids on two Palestinian villages in the south and east of Nablus. They also shot and injured two Palestinian teenagers in a village near the city of Ramallah. Our correspondent Mona Kandil joined us earlier to give more details regarding the latest escalation of violence and killings in the occupied West Bank.
In Al-Khalil, south occupied West Bank, Palestinians throw stones because Israeli forces used live rounds and rubber-coated bullets. A number of Palestinians were wounded. 28-year-old Ahmed Al-Atrash was seriously wounded and then succumbed to his injuries. We have to mention that Al-Atrash was a Palestinian prisoner. He spent 8 years in Israeli jails. The Palestinian Commission of Prisoners Affairs, of course, denounced the killing in cold blood of this Palestinian, because Palestinians were taking part in a peaceful demonstration against the Israeli practices in Al-Khalil and mainly in the Ash-Shuhada street, because the Israeli settlers continue to attack Palestinians there, prevent them to move freely in Ash-Shuhada street because of the numerous Israeli settlements. Another clashes took place this time in the town of Beita, mainly in the Sbeh mountain. As every Friday, Palestinians took part in an anti-settlement demonstration. There, Israeli forces attacked the peaceful protesters. Elsewhere in the occupied West Bank, also protests took place against the Israeli settlement and the Israeli separation wall.
The UN says Yemen's warring parties have agreed to a two-month truce starting Saturday ahead of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. The UN Special Envoy for Yemen says the truce can be extended with the consent of the parties. Hans Grundberg added, warring parties accepted to halt air, ground, and maritime operations inside Yemen and across its borders. The UN proposed ceasefire would also ease sea and air restrictions imposed on the areas controlled by the Ansar Allah movement to help alleviate a dire humanitarian crisis. Yemen's former government has vowed to facilitate releasing prisoners, opening Sana'a airport, and allowing fuel vessels to dock in Hodeidah port. Saudi Arabia and Ansar Allah have welcomed the truce. Riyadh and its allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in 2015, plunging it into what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. We've talked to activist and political commentator Hussein Al-Bukhaiti to get his thoughts on the UN proposed ceasefire in Yemen. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
Saudi actually is the main part in this war and blockade against Yemen, so they can claim whatever they want and they can force the so-called Hadi government to release any statement. They could say that Yemeni has not respected this truce. They have attacked here or there. And on the other hand, we have actually had many ceasefire, but it has been always broken by Saudi Arabia. But anyway, in the coming days and week, it's going to be clear. Will Saudi actually respect this ceasefire? And I believe if they will respect it, it's not because they care about Yemeni civilians, because blocking food and fuel is a war crime that the Saudi has been doing for the last 7 years. But I think as well because of the oil shortages in the international market, especially with the war in Ukraine, that has actually led to a high increase in fuel prices in Europe and in the United States. That's why I think this agreement, they want the United States, they want to protect Saudi oil field.
And the draw for the 2022 FIFA World Cup has been made in Doha, and Iran have joined England and the U.S. in an interesting group, not just for footballing reasons. In a ceremony attended by Iran's all-time leading scorer, Ali Doi, as a draw assistant, Team Ali were picked as the third seed in Group B. The Iranian Cheetahs will begin their quest against England on the opening day of the World Cup on November the 21st. This will be Iran's sixth appearance on football's biggest stage. Ukraine, Scotland, or Wales will compete for the last spot in the group during European playoffs in June. While there was no traditional group of death, the draw did offer some tantalizing fixtures, such as the clashes between Spain and Germany in Group E and Portugal and Uruguay in Group H. Reigning champions France and five-time world champions Brazil should both have an easy route out of their groups, respectively. Islamabad has lodged a formal protest with the U.S. over what it calls Washington's interference in Pakistan's internal affairs. This a day after the prime minister accused the U.S. of being behind a letter that warns of dire consequences if no confidence motion against Imran Khan fails. Kamar Youssef has the details from Islamabad.
In his 50-minute televised address on Thursday, Pakistan's embattled Prime Minister Imran Khan came up with serious allegations against the U.S.
They say they're angry with Pakistan. They make this excuse. They say they will forgive Pakistan if Imran Khan loses in the no-trust move. But if the move fails, Pakistan will have to go through a difficult time.
The so-called threat letter was based on the conversation between the Pakistani ambassador in Washington and the U.S. officials. According to the government, U.S. officials were unhappy with Pakistan over its neutral stance on the Russia-Ukraine crisis. The letter then goes on to say that Pakistan would be isolated if the vote of no confidence against Imran Khan failed. This has led the government to conclude that the no-trust move of opposition has the backing of the U.S. Pakistan has summoned a senior diplomat in Islamabad and lodged a formal protest over the controversy.
It's a serious thing, very serious, that pertains to Pakistan's national security. And the onus lies on the Prime Minister Imran Khan that he should bring forth, tell the nation, tell the stakeholders that what is the conspiracy.
Opposition parties have strongly rejected allegations that the U.S. was behind their no-confidence motion. The government also says it has uncovered a plot to assassinate Prime Minister Khan. All this is happening just ahead of the crucial vote of no-confidence against the Prime Minister on Sunday.
Prime Minister Khan is linking the vote of no-confidence with a foreign conspiracy. Despite losing a majority in the parliament, the embattled Prime Minister insists he would not step down. This means the political battle would go all down to the wire. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
And Iran is marking the 43rd anniversary of the establishment of the Islamic Republic. Yusuf Jalali has attended a flag-raising ceremony that marks the national occasion in the capital, Tehran, and has filed this report.
The Iranian flag was hoisted high in Tehran on a day that's remembered as a milestone in Iran's history. April 1, 1979 was the day when the Islamic Republic replaced 3 millennia of monarchy in Iran. This came in a referendum held months after the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution that overthrew the former Pahlavi regime. The ballots contained yes or no to the Islamic Republic, and more than 98% of the eligible voters chose to vote yes.
April 1st is the Islamic Republic Day. It was a day when the monarchy gave way to democracy. We as Iranians honor this major occasion and celebrate it every year.
The Islamic Republic blessed Iran with independence and self-reliance. Today, Iran has its own industry and economy, which are not reliant on foreign countries.
The event also invited ambassadors to Iran, who took part to congratulate Iranians on the occasion.
We have a very long history of relationship with Iran, 119 years. Next year, we will be celebrating 120 years of diplomatic relations between our countries. So our relations have always been very good, sometimes closer, sometimes not so close. But in the last years, we have had very good relations, trade relations, political relations.
Led by Imam Khomeini, the Islamic Revolution was driven by anti-imperialist sentiments, since former Iranian monarch Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was believed to be heavily dependent on Western powers, especially the U.S. Iranian officials say independence is one of the accomplishments brought about by the Islamic Republic in Iran.
43 years have passed since the establishment of the Islamic Republic, and well-wishers are trying to deal a blow to the establishment, but because we are an independent country in every sense of the world, enemies have not been able to harm our nation using sanctions and pressures.
Since its establishment, the Islamic Republic has faced many challenges, from the Western-funded Iraqi war to the stringent sanctions imposed against the country by the U.S. and Europe. Authorities of the Islamic Republic say the establishment has reached maturity in its fourth decade of life and will not surrender to Western pressures.
The Islamic Republic revolutionized everything in Iran, even its flag, which used to bear the lion and sun emblem as a symbol of monarchy, and later was replaced by God's name, Allah, in the center, a reflection of the Iranians' Islamic beliefs, which they say were not addressed during the Shah era. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The humanitarian situation in Afghanistan has turned into one of the world's worst crises. The international community has failed to do enough to help ease the suffering of Afghans. Now, Afghanistan's neighboring countries are spearheading efforts to bring Afghanistan back from the edge.
Afghanistan has suffered crisis after crisis over the past decades, but the situation has perhaps never been so grave. Afghan people now have to live with the terrible mess left after so many years of war. There is no doubt that most of the problems facing the South Asian nation have their roots in war. The United States and its Western allies have been widely criticized for their 20-year military campaign, which wreaked havoc in the country but failed to achieve its stated goals. Afghanistan is now at a critical point. It has turned into a historic test for the international community. This week, top diplomats from Afghanistan's neighboring countries gathered in China for their third conference on the situation. They seem to understand better than other countries what is at stake if Afghanistan fails completely. The foreign ministers of neighboring countries called on the Taliban to adopt further measures to improve living conditions and guarantee the basic rights of all Afghans, including women and ethnic minorities. The foreign ministers also renewed their call on the Taliban to form an inclusive government.
I think that there's potential significance in it if they can manage to produce the aid. And not only money aid, but if they can organize food shipments and fuel shipments and this sort of thing into Afghanistan and pressure for equitable distribution where it's necessary, then of course this conference could save Afghanistan.
Iran, which is hosting several million Afghan refugees, said during the conference that neighboring and friendly countries should strengthen cooperation in the reconstruction of Afghanistan and boost assistance to its people without political considerations. At the conference in China, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian proposed a security mechanism to coordinate counterterrorism policies by the neighbors. He also stressed that the root cause of problems in Afghanistan is the long-term occupation and misguided policies of the occupiers, mainly the United States.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Capitalism eventually ruins all good things, says Jonathan Rosenblum, writer, in an article published under the heading Higher Education is Now a Battlefield Between Workers and Corporatization in the United States. Here's the story. capitalism eventually ruins all good things. Corporate CEOs override COVID safety measures with demands to reopen the economy, a sanitized term for keep our profits flowing. Wall Street's next quarterly earnings trump measures to address the climate crisis. Even social housing, food, and medical programs originally intended to uplift humanity are disciplined to monetize everything and embrace business models that differentiate the deserving from the undeserving. Higher education, too, has been a central area of a struggle between profit motive and social good. As Joe Berry and Helena Wothen note in their book, Power Despite Precarity, Strategies for the Contingent Faculty Movement in Higher Education, in the last 40 years, we have seen higher education transformed into a profit-seeking industry. The flow of money through the whole project of academic research has distorted what is studied, what is judged, what is published, and who has access to it. And with soaring tuition, endless fees, and hidden add-on costs, also with privatized student loans and soaring student debt, the higher ed industry, like the real estate industry and its sibling, the finance industry, has found a way to suck down the wealth accumulated by the previous generation during the 1950s and 1960s. Look beyond higher ed's Latinate mottos and lofty pins to truth and knowledge to see what's steering the ship of higher education. Just survey the building names at your local university. In the hometown of Seattle, you can stroll to the University of Washington's Bank of America Executive Education Center, adjacent to the business school housed in PACCAR Hall, named for the Belvoir truck manufacturer, in recognition of its $16 million gift to the UW. Walk south on your right. You will see the William H. Gates Law School, named for corporate lawyer and father of Microsoft founder and centibillionaire Bill Gates. Then go past the former physics building, now Christianized after the elder Gates' wife, Mary Gates, between the two computer science buildings bearing the names of Bill Gates and Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen, and across the pedestrian overpass to catch a basketball game at the Alaska Airlines Arena, or perhaps a tennis match at the adjacent Nordstrom Tennis Center. Mind you, this is supposed to be a public institution. The ego-boosting naming rights and the tax deductions that these elites reap, along with the governing board positions that their generosity purchases, are accessory benefits to their real objective. The creation and maintenance of a publicly funded assembly line producing the intellectual capital necessary to feed their voracious private profit machines. Fortunately, this dystopian vision is not without organized resistance. It's centered in the growing army of precarious university workers who together perform most of the teaching and research in higher ed. 50 years ago, more than three quarters of university faculty were tenure or tenure track, and only one quarter were temporary teachers or adjuncts. Today, those members have flipped, with 75% of college classroom teachers being precariously employed as adjuncts, lecturers, or doctoral candidate teaching assistants. They have no long-term job security. They must stay keenly on the lookout every year, or even every academic term, to secure their next teaching or research gig. It's not that different from the Uber drivers hustling for the next ride. These are the frontline workers of the academy, and they see and experience firsthand the damage that corporatization inflicts. For students, the stress of deep debts, high rents, and a lack of proper support. For the teachers, poverty pay, housing insecurity, deferred medical care, and the mental burdens that every precarious worker bears in the capitalist economy. Assad's administration's downsized tenure and conjured up a mass workforce of precariously employed teachers and researchers, the new proletariat organized. Today, a significant percentage of the teachers from community colleges to major public and private research institutions have formed unions to battle for better job security, higher pay, decent benefits, and reasonable workloads. Power Despite Precarity takes a deep dive into one front in this global battlefield. Authors Barry and Wolfen, who combined have decades of teaching and academic organizing experience, offer the reader an extended classroom-level case study of how educators in the California State University system organized and built power. First, by taking on and overcoming institutional inertia and elitism within their own union ranks, and then by challenging the university administration. The authors describe how, in 1960, California established a plan that intended to open up higher education broadly by making it free at all levels: community colleges, Cal State universities, and the University of California system. This notion of education as a social good, as opposed to commodity to be purchased, has been at the center of the struggle, not just in California, but nationwide over the last 60 years.
Food for thought.
The Lady of Light, the Prophet's Immaculate Daughter, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, has been quoted in explaining the philosophy behind some of the basic tenets of Islam in the following passage. Never become angry with others and do not ask anything from them. Wish for the people whatever you wish for yourself.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى بن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mehdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Now we find that Imam Musa al-Kazim's life, in all of its various dimensions, is distinguished in a few things. First of all, he is distinguished in the firmness and the strength for which he stood up for when it came to the right, to truth, to haq. We also find his steadfastness in front of all kinds of events, trials and tribulations, good or bad. And we also see Imam Musa al-Kazim's luminous behavior, his actions, his morals, and his ethics, of which no deviation or crookedness has ever been reported. And finally, the life of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam is marked by balance. It is in harmony with that of the life of the Prophet Muhammad. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام ليس من دواء إلا وهو يهيج داء وليس شيء في البدن أنفع من إمساك اليد إلا عما يحتاج إليه.
إمام موسى الكاظم عليه السلام stated there is no medicine except that it exacerbates another ailment, and there is nothing more beneficial to the body than self-restraint from all except that which the body needs.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. In the beautiful dialogues and conversations of this divinely appointed Imam, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam, we find that Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam talked to his companions about this concept of following the lowly desires of the self. And so Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam, he spoke about this idea that one should not follow the low desires of the self. For surely this self will lead you astray. It will lead you towards extravagance in all kinds of different aspects. To retain control, to stay under control, and to be in control is one of the key aspects and characteristics of a believer. And so we find that Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam spoke to his companions in this dialogue and he said, guard against the easy ascent when its slope is rugged. For surely, my father has said, do not leave the soul alone with its low desires, for its low desires destroys the soul. Leaving the soul alone with what it desires will harm it, and preventing the soul from what it desires will cure it. It's so interesting. So we have two conversations. One is the conversation of Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam with his companion, and the other is the conversation of Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam with his esteemed father, His Eminence Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam. And so here in these two conversations, we understand that we should never leave the soul alone, meaning leave ourselves free, wild, without any control, because what happens is that the low desires, they will begin to try to take control. And these low desires, as Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam, will destroy the self, it will destroy the soul. So for example, greed or jealousy, pride and arrogance, all these kind of low desires that an individual has, these animalistic desires, if you say, they will surely destroy the soul. And if you leave the soul alone, then the things that are these low desires will harm the soul. It will damage the soul. It's just like addiction. When you become addicted to something, addicted has a negative connotation to it because you get addicted to things that are bad. When you get addicted to things that are bad, they destroy your life, they destroy your soul. And on the other hand, Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam, he says that to prevent the soul from these low desires cures it, purifies it, cleanses it, strengthens it. It makes the soul more powerful. The beautiful words of advice in this dialogue of Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program Dialogue. I'm Attar, the producer of this program, and at this moment I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Abbas Mirza about Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
For about 20 years, the seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam, was in the service of Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam's mother, who was a Moroccan origin, was also a very renowned and pious personality who have definitely contributed in the purity of the sixth Imam as well. When we look at the period, the political period, at that time, we find that Imam have attended or Imam faced about six tyrannical khulafa. Sajjah, who was known to be the most furious, the blood-sucking Khalifa of that time, because the period is where we are seeing the downfall of the Umayyads and the coming to power of the Abbasids. So it's a time where there is a lot of turmoil. Everyone who is about to lose the power want to be extremely furious, extremely, you know, bloodthirsty, want to rule with the iron fist so that they could save the power. And the tyrants and the oppressors and the khulafa who wants to come to power once again, responding or trying to come to power with the iron fist as well. So it was Sajjah, and then after that it was Mansur al-Dawaniqi, who was also a very cruel, cunning figure in the Islamic history, who have even brought Imam from Medina to Baghdad. And as soon as Imam was summoned, basically forced to come, and there is that very famous dua of Imam Kazim alayhi salam that we have in Mafati and also in other dua books, which reflects that unique understanding of the Imam in regards to Tawheed, in regards to Tawheedi principles. That dua is fascinating and amazing. Highly recommend to be recited on the 25th of Rajab.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
A super rare birth has added a cute member to critically endangered Sumatran rhinos of Indonesia. The newborn calf is the sixth born since intensive efforts to breed the species began in the 1980s. The female calf, which doesn't have a name yet, was given birth to by a rhino named Rosa in a sanctuary. Rosa has suffered 8 miscarriages since 2005 when she was brought in from the wild for a breeding program. Fewer than 80 Sumatran rhinos remain in the world, mainly on the Indonesian islands of Sumatra and Borneo. Excessive poaching, along with other threats, has brought the species to the brink of extinction. The cherry blossom or sakura season in the Japanese capital is a magical experience as trees burst into bloom, dousing the streets with stunning shades of pink. This year, people are enjoying the occasion to the fullest as COVID restrictions are no more there. Thousands gathered in central Tokyo wearing masks, taking pictures and posing for selfies among the trees. Cherry flowers reach full bloom on Sunday, 4 days earlier than usual, according to the Japan Meteorological Agency. The age-old tradition of viewing cherry blossoms typically takes place across the country. The flowers are a national obsession. People flock to parks to hold parties and picnics. However, due to the pandemic, authorities have asked people to refrain from eating and drinking outdoors.
Millions of people across the world celebrate Earth Hour, a symbolic lights out event that aims to call attention to environmental issues and the necessity of protecting the planet. The annual event encourages people to turn off their non-essential lighting for an hour and take a break from using electronic devices during that period. Earth Hour takes place every year on the last Saturday of March. The theme of this year's event is Shape Our Future and has been celebrated in more than 180 countries, including Greece, France, Thailand, and Iran. The initiative was first introduced in 2007 by the World Wildlife Fund as a grassroots movement for highlighting the collective responsibility of the people towards their environment. An ancient place in Guatemala with special significance for the Mayan culture could be the next entry on the World Heritage List. The historic village known today as the Takalik Abaj archaeological park was occupied for 1700 years before it was abandoned and discovered in 1888. It's said to have been home to a pre-Hispanic people. Archaeologists found their way to this mysterious piece of land where they found a series of exotic artifacts and sculptures back in 2008. Guatemala's Minister of Cultural Heritage says this site has a sacred place in the nation's culture.
Tikalikabaj is a sacred place with important links to Guatemala's culture. It's a place that harbors flora and fauna biodiversity and even Mayan spirituality and war is wild. This makes this place highly important within the Mayan culture in Guatemala.
Archaeologists believe the monuments go back to the deep-rooted civilizations of Olmec and Maya in a Central American culture around 400 BC. The government has presented the site to UNESCO, hoping it will be declared a World Heritage Site. A Belgian-British teenager is on a solo flight around the globe that could make him a world record holder. Mark Rutherford started his journey from a small airfield near the Bulgarian capital Sofia on Wednesday. His first destination is the island of Sicily in Italy. From there, he'll fly south to Africa and then around the globe to cross the finish line again in Bulgaria. The 16-year-old pilot says he got his inspiration from his sister.
Egypt's rich history seems to be a gift that keeps on giving. The country has unveiled some exquisite newly discovered tombs. The pharaonic tombs were found at the Saqqara archaeological site south of Cairo. The site is a big necropolis of Memphis, an ancient capital of Egypt. The graves belonged to a senior royal official, or rather senior royal officials. Some of the graves are engraved with interesting titles such as Steward of the Royal House and Supervisor of the Garden. The tombs are around 4,000 years old, dating back to the Old Kingdom of Egypt.
Nowruz, or the Persian New Year, is celebrated worldwide by millions of people, including the people in Indian-controlled Kashmir. The region, known for its natural beauty worldwide, turns magical each year during its spring season. To mark nature's revival, the people of Kashmir have dedicated a day to thank the mesmerizing beauty of spring. Our correspondent Shahana Bhatt reports.
As the spring season begins in Kashmir, the earth turns lush green and the trees bear colorful blossoms, with the sky visibly blue and waters clear and glossy. After a not-so-harsh winter this year, the people of Kashmir are welcoming the onset of spring. Nowruz, or the Persian New Year, marks the beginning of spring and is celebrated on March 21st. New trees are planted while people offer prayers and seek God's help for a prosperous year.
Each year we await this season so that we can plant new trees. The process of their growth gives us hope, and that hope teaches us that God has set a time for everything. We can't fast-track it. We can only do our best efforts.
On the occasion of Nowruz, women in Kashmir prepare unique dishes made from lotus stem and fish. Mehra and her sister have a busy day today. Friends and family are invited to relish the moment.
We have been taught by our mothers and grandmothers to cook these delicacies on the special occasion of Nowruz. It requires lots of dedication, and what matters is that this food brings friends and families together, and a lot of positive energy is exchanged. For us, Nowruz is not just an occasion, but it marks a fresh beginning of love, growth, and prosperity.
On the occasion of Nowruz, the Kashmiri administration often organizes musical festivals to add fervor to the celebrations. People, especially children, visit these musical festivals in large numbers so that the year starts with cheerful memories. This year, scores of tourists have also come to witness Kashmir's spring.
We had heard that Kashmir looks magical, but we witnessed in reality that this land looks fabulous, especially the spring season.
The early arrival of tourists has added a lot of positivity to Kashmir's tourism sector, which has been hit hard by years of political instability and turmoil. Persian culture is deeply rooted in Kashmir, and celebrating Nowruz is a sign of its influence.
Nowruz marks a new beginning, and after suffering decades of political instability and 2 years of the COVID pandemic, people are only hoping for a return back to a normal life and an everlasting peace. Shahana Butt, Indian administered Kashmir.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Turkey inaugurates the world's longest suspension bridge over the Dardanelles Strait. The bridge is more than 2 kilometers long and connects Turkey's European and Asian shores. It cuts travel time between the two locations to just 6 minutes. A consortium of Turkish and South Korean firms began constructing the huge bridge in 2017 with a budget of 2.5 billion euros. 5,000 workers participated in the colossal undertaking. Passenger vehicles must pay a fare of 200 Turkish liras or around $14 to use the bridge. In Peru, paleontologists have unearthed the skull of a ferocious marine predator that is an ancestor of the modern-day whale. The 36-million-year-old skull was dug up intact after it was discovered in Peru's southern desert. The fossil belongs to an ancient mammal whose contemporary descendants include dolphins. Recreations of how the animal looked like show it mostly resembles a giant lizard that moved like a snake. Paleontologists say it was a top predator measuring some 12 meters long.
The discovery is very important because the skull is in a perfect state of preservation. The skull and the jaw are in the right anatomical position. The teeth are complete. It's very possible this might be a new Basilosaurus species. If this is so, there is no other fossil like this one anywhere else in the world.
Salas further explained when the ancient animal died, its skull might have sunk to the bottom of the seafloor, where it was quickly preserved. The skull, measuring 1.3 meters long, was unveiled at Lima's Museum of Natural History. The Peruvian desert is rich in fossils and offers scientists 42 million years' worth of evolutionary evidence. Other fossils found there include the four-legged dwarf whale and sharks, among others. A painter in Pakistan shifts from trucks to trainers to uncover a hip new canvas for his famous truck art. Haydar Ali says he works on each pair of shoes for up to 4 days, and his paint of choice is mainly acrylic. He also uses other forms of durable material such as oil paints to get the job done. The seasoned artist charges select clients $400 for each set. His designs feature intricate bespoke patterns including flowers, peacocks, and wildly colorful motifs. He says new requests typically arrive every 4 days. Orders for painted trainers started pouring in for the truck artist after a surge of social media interest.
Ideas keep popping up for me, and sometimes clients have ideas. A client came to me from the US asking for a painting on some shoes. I told him an exorbitant fee to discourage him, but he agreed, so I decided, let's do it then.
He has dispatched 8 pairs to various places in Pakistan and abroad since he first started painting trainers in January. Ali comes from a family of truck artists who made a living off of painting lorries. He came to international fame when his work was exhibited at a museum in the U.S. 2 decades ago. So far, the veteran truck artist has applied his craft to an airplane as well as a passenger car, among others. The art form is mainly seen on Pakistani trucks, and today, the trade is one of the country's most famous cultural exports.
archaeologists have discovered a 500-year-old Aztec altar with 164 in Mexico City, Mexico's largest starfish offering discovered to date. Archaeologists believe it was built around the year 1500. Jaguar bones and other remains such as seashells were also found. Scientists believe the fossils found correspond to a species known as chocolate chip sea star or Nidorella armata.
This is really interesting because if you think about it, chocolate chip sea star looks like the skin of a jaguar. It's orange with dark spots. Probably that is why this species was selected, but we still need to analyze all the starfish because we found 160 of them and we think they all belong to the same species. But we need to research further every one of them.
According to experts, the location of the altar within the Templo Mayor complex and the jaguar motifs suggest the offering was related to the war. Mexico is brimmed with archaeological sites of several civilizations, including Aztecs.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
The hawks in Washington want to jack up the military budget and use Ukraine as an excuse, warned one analyst. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Biden asks Congress to approve record $813 billion in military spending. Here's the story. Rebuffing progressive lawmakers' calls for Pentagon spending cuts, President Joe Biden is set to unveil a budget blueprint for the next fiscal year that includes a record $813.3 billion in funds for the U.S. military apparatus, a $31 billion increase from the current level. The president's fiscal year 2023 budget request, which must be approved by Congress, is expected to contain $773 billion for the Pentagon alone, as well as billions in funding for the Energy Department's maintenance of the country's nuclear arsenal. The New York Times reported recently that Biden's funding request for the Pentagon, the only federal agency that has not passed an independent audit, will include owed $4.1 billion to conduct research and develop defense capabilities, nearly $5 billion for a space-based missile warning system to detect global threats, and nearly $2 billion for a missile defense interceptor.